The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 11.
News of the disturbances and the execution of Bonnet's men traveled quickly to Nassau, convincing Woods Rogers and his governing council of the need to move quickly against the 10 pirates they had in custody aboard the Delicia. Rogers was, if anything, in a more vulnerable position than Governor Johnson. Until his arrival, the Bahamas had been the epicenter of Atlantic piracy, and despite the departure of so many, the pirates and their followers still constituted the majority of inhabitants of New Providence. By late November 1718, Rogers had barely enough men to keep his 10 prisoners under guard, better yet, to defend the colony from Vane or a Spanish invasion fleet. His independent company had been reduced by disease, which even killed their surgeon. Of the 4 vessels he had brought with him, 3 were gone: the 10-gun Buck, stolen by pirates, the 20-gun Willing Mind, wrecked on a sandbar, and the 6-gun Samuel, on her way to London to secure more troops and supplies. The only thing standing between Rogers and his enemies were the Delicia, a poorly manned ruin of a fort, and the influence of Hornigold, Cockrum, and Josiah Burgess. The time had come for a final test of wills between Rogers and the island's pirate sympathizers. On December 9th, the prisoners were brought to the fort and escorted to a guard room where the trial was to be held. Robert Beecham, head of the independent company, had all 60 of his surviving soldiers guard the entrances before going inside. There he sat down with Rogers, Chief Justice William Fairfax, and 5 other men Rogers had appointed as justices, including reformed pirate Captain Burgess, now an officer in the militia, and Thomas Walker, who was no doubt pleased to finally be sitting in judgment over the pirates of the Bahamas. The trial lasted 2 days, during which time numerous witnesses testified to the guilt of 9 of the pirates. The last, John Hipps, proved to have been a forced man and was acquitted. The rest, including Blackbeard's former gunner, William Cunningham, were sentenced to death by hanging, with the execution set for 2 days thence. A few of the men begged Rogers to delay the execution, but the governor refused. According to the trial record, the governor told them that from the time of their being apprehended, they ought to have accounted themselves as condemned. On the morning of December 12th, a crowd of 300 formed at the base of the fort's northeastern rampart, a sandy shoreline where a gallows had been erected against the water's edge. The throng consisted almost entirely of former pirates, who might have been there to interrupt the proceedings. Few men besides the governor's adherents were spectators to the tragedy, the official trial record put it, but those who had lately deserved the same fate. At 10 a.m., the 9 prisoners were unchained from their ad hoc cell by the provost marshal and led under heavy guard to the top of the rampart. The crowd's behavior was erratic. Some cheered their former brethren. Others looked warily at the heavy cannon trained on them from the ramparts and the 100 armed soldiers, sailors, and officials posted there and around the perimeter of the gallows. Standing atop the rampart, most of the prisoners were cowed, including their ringleader, John Auger, who was dressed in filthy clothes and had neither washed nor shaved. In contrast, 28-year-old Dennis McCarthy and Thomas Morris, 22, were dressed flamboyantly, with long blue and red ribbons adorning their wrists, necks, knees, and skulls. Morris was in good humor, smiling frequently. McCarthy looked out on the crowd cheerfully before yelling out that he knew a time when there were many brave fellows on the island that would not suffer him to die like a dog. He kicked each of his shoes over the wall and into the crowd, adding that some friends of his had often said he should die in his shoes, but that he would make them liars. The crowd buzzed, but nobody attempted to rush the well-guarded fort. At the prisoner's request, the island's Huguenot priest read several prayers and psalms, in which all present joined. When the priest finished, the marshal conducted the prisoners one by one over the ramparts and down a ladder to the gallows. Thomas Morris paused at the top of the ladder to quip, "We have a good governor, but a harsh one." Near the foot of the ladder, 9 nooses hung over a single wooden stage, held up by 3 large barrels. Each was led to his appointed noose, where the hangman fastened the cords as dexterously as if he had been a servitor at Tyburn, London's primary execution site, the trial record noted. With hands tied behind their backs and a noose in place, the prisoners were allotted 45 minutes to say their final words, drink their last goblets of wine, and sing their last psalms before the boisterous crowd. Most of the prisoners set to drinking to deaden their fear, particularly William Lewis, a former prize fighter who was eager to toast fellow prisoners and bystanders alike. When Lewis asked for more wine, one of the sullen prisoners, William Ling, shot back that water was more suitable to them at this time. William Dowling, a 24-year-old Irishman, became so drunk that his behavior was very loose on stage. McCarthy and Morris hadn't given up on the crowd, exhorting them to rush the stage. According to the general history, Morris began taxing the spectators with pusillanimity and cowardice, as if it were a breach of honor in them not to rise and save them from the ignominious death they were going to suffer. Some of their old cohorts and others surged forward and got as near to the foot of the gallows as the marshal's guard would suffer them, according to the official account, but their wills saw too much power over their heads to practice anything. The moment passed, Rogers stepped forward to announce the last-minute reprieve of young George Rounceville, because, as he later explained, "I hear he is the son of loyal and good parents at Weymouth," in Rogers's native Dorset. The fortunate young man was untied and brought off the stage. The marshal's men then gripped the ropes tied to the barrels supporting the stage and waited for Rogers's signal. In these last moments, Morris yelled out that he might have been a greater plague to these islands, and now wished he had been so. Rogers gave the signal, the guards heaved on their ropes, and in the words of the official record, the stage fell and the 8 sprang off. As the 8 corpses swung from the gallows before the placid blue waters of Nassau Harbor, Rogers knew he had finally gained the upper hand. Indeed, Rogers would realize that the executions had dealt a mortal blow to those on the island who wished to overthrow his government. Sometime after Christmas, several disgruntled residents held a secret meeting where they hatched a plot to kill Rogers and his officers, and then to deliver up the fort for the use of the pirates. But opinion in Nassau was against the plotters. Some privy to the conspiracy passed word to Rogers, who had 3 of the ringleaders seized and punished with severe whipping. In the wake of the executions, the coup had garnered so little support that Rogers decided his new prisoners could do him no harm. "I shall release them," he wrote the British Secretary of State a few weeks later, "and be the more on my guard in future." The home front was secure, but Rogers faced other threats. He was still keeping a lookout for the Spanish, and also for Charles Vane and the handful of other pirates at large, still operating in and around the Bahamas. As Vane sailed south from Ocracoke in mid-October 1718, he must have felt disappointed. He had been unable to convince Blackbeard to join forces with him against Nassau, and had but 90 men aboard his 12-gun brigantine. Based on what his informants had told him, even Rogers's depleted forces at New Providence would be able to resist an attack by such a small contingent. If he were to oust the governor and restore the pirate republic, he would have to wait until he had accumulated a stronger force, or hope the Spanish would once again invade, destroy the government, and abandon the island. For now, he would have to content himself with smaller, softer targets. Harbor Island was also too strong for him, its fortifications well manned and maintained by Richard Thompson and the Cockrams. The farming hamlet on adjacent Eleuthera was another matter. There were only families living on the entire 200-square-mile island, and between them they could only muster a militia force of 70. Vane proposed that they sack Eleuthera, pillage supplies, and make south for sparsely populated Hispaniola to establish their own pirate camp and wait for events to unfold in the adjacent Bahamas. The company, which included Quartermaster Calico Jack Rackham and First Mate Robert Deal, agreed. The raid on Eleuthera was a complete success. The pirates came ashore, plundered the inhabitants of their liquor and as much of their livestock as could be carried away. The brigantine departed as quickly as it came, her decks crowded with live pigs, goats, sheep, and poultry, the makings of many a feast. On October 23rd, as they made their way south through the Bahamas, they captured two prizes, a small sloop and the 40-ton brigantine Endeavor of Salem, on her way home from Kingston. Vane bore down on him, hoisted a black flag, and fired a shot at him, the captain of the Endeavor, John Shattuck, later deposed. He ordered him to hoist out his boat and come on board him, which he did. Apparently, Shattuck's boat crew didn't row fast enough, because the pirates began yelling that they would fire a volley of small shot into them if they did not make haste. The pirates kept Shattuck's men aboard their vessel for 2 days, beating and abusing their captain, while they plundered the Endeavor of her gunpowder, salt, and whale oil. When Shattuck complained of his abuse, Robert Deal replied, "Damn you, old dog, then tell where your money is. If we find you in one lie, we'll damn you and your vessel also." The frightened captain told them what they wanted to know, and on the 25th was put aboard the Endeavor and allowed to sail away. Vane kept the small sloop as a tender and took her with him to Hispaniola. During their passage, the pirates lived riotously on board, drinking heavily and gorging on freshly slaughtered farm animals. Perhaps as a result of these excesses, they failed to capture a single vessel for the better part of a month. As they slaughtered the last chickens and drank the dregs of their wine casks, the pirates' morale began to wane. They had forsaken the pardon in the hopes of living merry, acquiring riches, and pestering the forces of the Hanoverian king. Now they found themselves sober, bored, and filled with discontent. The sour mood lifted on November 23rd, when their lookout spotted a large frigate-rigged ship downwind of their position. Vane ordered the brigantine and sloop to bear down on her and ran a black flag up his mainmast, expecting the ship to surrender as almost everyone before her had done. Instead, the ship's captain ran up a white flag studded with tiny gold fleur-de-lis, the ensign of the French Navy. Cannon muscles rolled out of her heretofore unnoticed gun ports, and in a thunderous, rolling explosion, the French man-of-war blasted Vane's brigantine with a full broadside. By concealing their guns until the last minute, however, the French gunners were apparently unable to aim them properly, as the brigantine suffered little or no damage from the opening salvo. Vane was not one to back off from a fight, but seeing himself outgunned, he ordered his vessels to swing around and run away into the wind. The French frigate trimmed her sails and, to Vane's surprise, followed them. Then, as a captive later recalled, the pirates quarreled among themselves about how to proceed. Vane was for escaping, but Quartermaster Jack Rackham and much of the crew wanted to take on the man of war, arguing that though she had more guns and a greater weight of metal, they might board her, and then the best boys would carry the day. Vane responded that it was too rash and desperate an enterprise, the man of war appearing to be twice their force, 24 guns, and that their brigantine might be sunk by her before they could get on board. Deal and 15 other pirates agreed, but the other 75 supported Rackham. Unwilling to embark on what he considered a suicide mission, Vane pulled rank, forcing the pirates to retreat by dint of his absolute power as captain while fighting, chasing, or being chased. The company was outraged, but respecting the articles they'd signed, followed orders, tightening their sails and ultimately leaving the French frigate in their wake. The incident cost Vane dearly. The next day, the pirates were out of danger, putting an end to Vane's war powers. Jack Rackham, clad in his multicolored Indian prints, called a meeting of the ship's company to challenge Vane's rule by a vote of confidence. A resolution passed against Vane's honor and dignity, the author of the General History wrote a few years later, branding him with the name of coward, deposing him from command, and turning him out of the company with marks of infamy. Vane, Deal, and 15 loyalists were put aboard the sloop the pirates had captured off Long Island, with some provisions and ammunition. Rackham, whom the pirates had elected as their new captain, sailed away in the brigantine, bound for Jamaica. Vane had been deposed from command. After all of his bravado, defying the Royal Navy, blockading cities, putting entire colonies into a state of terror, Vane's pirating career ended with a whimper. Reduced to a single sloop, 15 men, and a cannon or two, Vane was no longer in a position to threaten His Majesty's governments. But he tried to rebuild all the same. As they sailed south for the jungle-carpeted shores of the Bay of Honduras, he and Deal did their best to transform the puny vessel from tender to gunboat, mounting cannon, shifting ballast, and modifying the rigging. In late November, they tarried several days off the northwest coast of Jamaica, capturing two periaguas and a sloop, and convincing most or all of their crews to join the company. Deal took command of the second sloop, and the pirates continued southwards. They reached an anchorage in the Bay of Honduras on December 16th, where they surprised two merchant sloops and kept them to help careen their vessels. A few days later, Vane made what would be his final capture. The Prince, a 40-ton sloop from Kittery, Maine, sailed by Captain Thomas Walden. His men now scattered among five vessels, Vane led the way to their ultimate destination, the Bay Islands, 40 miles off the coast of Honduras. The Bay Islands made the perfect nest for a pirate captain on the mend. They had served as a retreat for generations of freebooters from Henry Morgan to John Coxon. Lush, mountainous, and out of the way, the islands had everything Vane's men needed. Fresh springs, secluded anchorages, timber, game, and fish-infested coral reefs located so close to the shore one could practically wade to them. Vane set up camp at Guanaja, which had an anchorage on the southern shore with no less than seven entrances and exits between sharp reefs and sandbars. Here, from late December to early February, Vane cleaned his vessels, chatted with his men, and feasted on fish, crabs, and salt pork on the island's beaches. At the end of this peaceful interlude, Vane and Deal loaded up their respective sloops and sailed out to cruise the Spanish Main, no doubt hoping to overwhelm a ship of force that would get them back to the top of their game. A few days out to sea, the pirates were overtaken by a violent hurricane. Vane and Deal lost each other amid the towering seas and screaming winds, and after being battered for 2 days, Vane's sloop was driven ashore on a small uninhabited island in the Bay of Honduras. The vessel was smashed to pieces, and in the process, most of her crew and all of the food and supplies aboard her were lost. Vane survived, but was reduced to great straits for want of necessaries. He lived as a castaway for several weeks, kept alive by the charity of visiting turtle hunters who came from the mainland in dories and provided him with meat. The turtlers must have been a pathetic lot, as Vane preferred to stay on the island rather than join them in their jungle camps. He knew an English merchant vessel was bound to show up in search of water or firewood and take him back to civilization. He was proven right when, sometime in the late winter or early spring of 1719, a ship from Jamaica dropped anchor off his island. Vane greeted them and was surprised to learn that their captain was an old friend, a retired buccaneer by the name of Halford. But Halford knew of his old friend's reputation and refused to take him aboard. "Charles, I shan't trust you aboard my ship unless I carry you prisoner," he is said to have told the sorry pirate. "Otherwise, I shall find you caballing with my men to knock me on the head and run away with my ship, a-pirating." He put Vane ashore, telling him that he would return in about a month with a load of logwood. "If I find you upon this island when I come back," he vowed, "I'll carry you to Jamaica and hang you." Luckily for Vane, before the month was up, a different ship put in for water, one whose captain and crew did not know him. Eager to get off the island, Vane gave a false name and signed on as a crewman for the remainder of the voyage. Halford arrived at the anchorage shortly thereafter, and the captain of the vessel on which Vane was now crewing invited Halford aboard for dinner. While making his way down the deck to the captain's cabin, Halford happened to glance down into the hold and spotted Vane at work. He went straight to the captain, a friend of his, and advised him of the castaway's true identity and reputation. Halford, who was on his way back to Jamaica, volunteered to carry him to justice. Vane soon found himself at gunpoint while Halford's crewmen clamped him into irons. The crew of a humble trading vessel had captured the most notorious pirate in the Americas. A week or two later, Vane was home in Jamaica, a prisoner of the king he so despised. For reasons that are unclear, he was allowed to rot in jail for the better part of a year before being brought to trial in Spanish Town, the Jamaican capital, on March 22, 1721. He knew the verdict would not be in doubt. Numerous witnesses came to testify against him, captains, crewmen, and passengers from various vessels he had captured, and even Vincent Pierce of the HMS Phoenix, who related how Vane had made a mockery of the king's pardon. When it was Vane's turn to present his defense, he called no witnesses and asked no questions. His piracy career had started aboard one of Lord Hamilton's privateers. Now it was Hamilton's successor, Governor Nicholas Laws, who pronounced what he termed the usual sentence, to be hanged by the neck till he was dead, and the Lord have mercy on his soul. On Wednesday, March 29, 1721, Charles Vane was hanged at Gallows Point in Port Royal. Governor Laws had his corpse cut down, carried to Gun Cay at the harbor's entrance, where it hung in chains from a gibbet for all mariners to see. Over the months and years that followed, they watched his apparition disappear, bit by bit, ravaged by birds, insects, and the elements, until all that was left of Vane and the golden age of piracy were the stories told by the tavern fire or in hammocks between the decks of 1,000 creaking, miserable ships. Epilogue. Piracy's End, 1720 to 1732. With the execution of the pirates at Nassau in December 1718, Woodes Rogers no longer feared his government would be brought down by a coup, but the threat from the Spaniards remained. Throughout the winter of 1718 to 1719, he did his best to put the impoverished colony on a good defensive footing, prodding his indolent subjects to shore up Fort Nassau, writing requests for reinforcements, and begging unsuccessfully for naval support from Commodore Chamberlain, commander of the Jamaica Squadron. In March 1719, he received official word that Britain and Spain were again at war, the War of the Quadruple Alliance, that pitted Spain against Britain, France, Austria, and the Netherlands. And he promptly handed out privateering commissions to many of the Bahamas' former pirates, most of whom were probably eager to return to pirate-like work. When his government ran out of funds shortly thereafter, Rogers paid, fed, and supplied the colony's sailors and soldiers with money out of his own pocket, expecting to be reimbursed by his fellow investors or the crown. Despite these efforts, Rogers knew the Bahamas were in no way ready to repel a serious invasion attempt. A Spanish invasion fleet sailed from Cuba in May 1719, carrying 3,000 to 4,000 troops. Had it attacked New Providence as planned, it would certainly have rolled over the island's paltry defenses. En route, however, the Spanish Commodore received word that the French, Britain's allies this time around, had captured a strategically important fortress at Pensacola. The fleet therefore turned around and sailed for that settlement on Florida's Gulf Coast, sparing the Bahamas for another 9 months. Rogers continued pushing and prodding Nassau's very lazy citizenry to finish the fort. A close brush with invasion prompted everyone to pitch in, but only for a couple of weeks, after which most abandoned their work sites, leaving Rogers with a few of the best of them, ye Negroes and my own men. Receiving no financial assistance from the crown, he continued to purchase vital war supplies on credit, 20,000 pounds worth by the end of 1719, some of it under his own name, rather than on behalf of his investment group. Many suppliers started cutting him off for non-payment. Having no news of my bills being paid at home, I am forced to run too much in debt, he alerted officials of the Council of Trade and Plantations in early 1720. I must continue doing so, or we shall starve, or be a sacrifice to the Spaniards. His letter went unanswered, as had every single letter he had sent them. In fact, he hadn't heard from anyone in the central government for the better part of a year. With the pirates defeated, King George's administration seemed to have forgotten the Bahamas' existence. Rogers hadn't gotten much support from the Navy either, whose captains, in Rogers's words, had little regard for this infant colony. In his first year as governor, only two men-of-war visited Nassau, one to deliver official mail, the other, Captain Whitney's Rose, forced in for fresh water by poor sailing conditions. I observed a general dissatisfaction in the governor, Whitney sniffed in a report to the Admiralty. Rogers was still complaining for want of help, which I'm afraid he and his fellow investors will always be in till they have redeemed their credits, paid their bills, throughout America. Even so, when a Spanish invasion fleet appeared off Nassau on February 24, 1720, Rogers was able to face them with a 50-gun fort, the 10-gun Eastern Battery, the Delicia, 100 soldiers, and 500 armed militiamen. By fortune, the 6th-rate frigate HMS Flamborough, 24 guns, was in Nassau at the time, although Rogers had to browbeat her abrasive captain, John Hildesley, to stay and defend the island. The Spanish, by contrast, had three frigates of 40, 26, and 22 guns, a 12-gun brigantine, 8 armed sloops, and an invasion force of 1,300 men. Rogers' defenses dissuaded the Spanish from a direct assault on the harbor. Instead, they landed on the backside of Hog Island and, in the middle of the night, attempted to cross the narrow eastern channel in small boats. A pair of heroic sentries, both free blacks, somehow managed to fire enough musket rounds to frighten the Spaniards into retreat. Ironically, two men who had probably been slaves themselves had saved Rogers, a professional slave dealer. The Bahamas were secured, but the effort exhausted Rogers's physical and financial resources. The imperial government continued to ignore his letters. Merchants denied him credit, and his colony's economy remained paralyzed for lack of productive settlers. Stressed and exhausted, Rogers was in such poor health that he nearly died on two occasions. In November 1721, he spent 6 weeks in South Carolina, hoping a rest in the cooler climate and more genteel surroundings of Charleston would repair his health. Instead, he found the city in political upheaval, and while there was wounded in a duel with Captain Hildesley of the HMS Flamborough, relating to disputes they had at New Providence. He sent one last set of letters to London before returning to Nassau, begging support and instructions. They, like many others before them, went unanswered. By midwinter, Rogers could bear it no longer. "I can subsist no longer on the foot I have been left ever since my arrival," he wrote the Council of Trade on February 23, 1722. "I have no other satisfactions left me in this abandoned place and condition, except having done my duty to His Majesty and my country, though at the hazard of my entire ruin." Leaving the colony in the hands of William Fairfax, Rogers sailed for England a month later, hoping face-to-face meetings would prove more productive than his correspondence. He arrived in London in August to learn that King George had fired him, and a new governor was already on his way to Nassau. Worse, his fellow investors had liquidated the co-partners for carrying on a trade and settling the Bahama Islands, making no allowance for the £6,000 Rogers had personally advanced on their behalf. Rogers was ruined once again. His creditors moved in on him, and before long he found himself locked in debtor's prison. The man who had captured a Manila galleon, dispersed the pirates of the Caribbean, and successfully defended a critical strategic asset from an invasion force twice his strength, was left behind bars. Many former pirates became privateers during the course of the War of the Quadruple Alliance, with varying degrees of success. Benjamin Hornigold, founder of the Pirate Republic, took his commission from Rogers and cruised against Spanish pirates from the familiar shelter of Nassau Harbor. In the spring of 1719, while lurking near Havana, his vessel was captured by a Spanish ship and brigantine. He either died in the engagement or in a Cuban prison, as his Bahamian colleagues never saw him again. Josiah Burgess, once Nassau's third most powerful pirate, served Rogers as a lieutenant of the Independent Company, a justice of the Vice Admiralty Court, and a privateer. In the latter capacity, his vessel was wrecked near Abaco. Burgess drowned, along with George Rounsevelle, the young man Rogers pardoned at the gallows, who went back in the water to try to rescue him. Henry Jennings and Lee Ashworth both operated privateers out of Jamaica. Jennings was particularly successful, arriving in New York in October 1719 on his trusty Barsheba with two brigantines and a sloop taken from the Spaniards off Veracruz. Jennings survived the war and returned to respectable merchant service out of Bermuda. In 1745, during the War of the Austrian Succession, his sloop was captured in the West Indies. Prison may have proven fatal to a man in his early 60s. Ashworth's fate is unclear, but in May 1719 he was again stepping over the line between privateering and piracy, by attacking one of Rogers's privateers and kidnapping one of Thomas Walker's sons off Cuba. Others jumped over the line with both feet, and none more infamously than Vane's old quartermaster, Calico Jack Rackham. Rackham didn't lack for courage, but perhaps for judgment. After abandoning Vane in November 1718, he convinced his band to cruise just off the shore of Jamaica, a particularly dangerous environment, as the island was home to the Royal Navy's West Indies Fleet and a large number of armed merchant vessels. With risk came rewards. On December 11th, the pirates lay chase to the merchant ship Kingston, overtaking her so close to Port Royal that the townspeople watched the attack. The ship, it turned out, was carrying a cargo valued at £20,000, much of it in the form of a large parcel of gold watches hidden in the bulk cargo. Her Jamaican owners were not going to let such a brazen theft succeed. As it happened, there were no warships in the harbor, but with the governor's blessing, the owners outfitted a pair of privateering vessels to recover their ship. 3 months later, in early February 1719, the privateers finally found the Kingston at Isla de los Pinos, south of Cuba. Rackham's brigantine was anchored alongside, but most of her crew was ashore, sleeping off hangovers under the brigantine sails, which they'd converted into temporary tents and awnings. Surprised, and in no condition to defend themselves, Rackham's company fled into the woods, hiding there until the privateers left with the Kingston and most of her cargo. Rackham and his men were left with two boats, a canoe, a few small arms, 20 silver watches, and several large bales of silk stockings and laced hats. After donning the finery, the pirates became divided over how to proceed. From their captives, they had learned that King George had extended his pardon, the same extension that had allowed some of Blackbeard's men to escape hanging in Virginia. Rackham and six followers decided to take the pardon in Nassau, where they might claim that Vane had forced them into piracy. They left in one of the boats and worked their way around the eastern tip of Cuba, capturing various Spanish boats along the way. Rackham arrived in Nassau in mid-May 1719 and convinced Rogers to pardon his men. They lived in Nassau for a while, hawking watches and stockings, drinking in what taverns and brothels still remained. Rogers, who continued to distribute Protestant religious pamphlets to the ex-pirates, presumably clamped down on some of Nassau's moral excesses. As their money ran out, Rackham's friends shipped out on privateers or merchant sloops. Rackham, with his captain's double share of plunder, lasted the longest. During this time, he made the acquaintance of one of New Providence's most infamous harlots, Anne Bonny, wife of James Bonny, a rank-and-file pirate who had become one of Rogers's informants. Rackham took a fancy to the fiery young woman, who swore like a pirate and had cuckolded at her husband on a great many occasions. He spent the last of his money courting her, then shipped out on one of Burgess's final privateering missions and spent his share of the proceeds on his new flame. The two fell in love, and sometime in the spring or early summer of 1720, approached James Bonny to seek an annulment of their marriage. Bonny agreed to do so in exchange for a substantial cash payment, but they would need a respectable witness to sign the appropriate papers. They chose their witness poorly. Richard Turnley, a mariner despised in some circles for having piloted HMS Rose safely into the harbor when Rogers first arrived, not only refused to act as witness, he informed Governor Rogers of the situation. Rogers, perhaps having read too many of the religious pamphlets he'd brought with him, told Bonny that if she annulled her marriage, he would have her thrown in prisons where he would force Rackham to whip her. Anne promised to be very good, to live with her husband and keep loose company no more. She had no intention of doing any of these things. Unable to continue their relationship ashore, Rackham and Bonnie decided to take to the sea as pirates. The couple recruited a half-dozen disgruntled former pirates, as well as Anne's close friend, a cross-dressing female sailor named Mary Read. The author of A General History of the Pirates erroneously claimed that Bonnie and Read met at sea when Read, dressed as a man, was pressed into service aboard Rackham's pirate sloop. According to this oft-repeated account, Bonnie took a liking to the fresh-faced recruit, only discovering her true gender after making the moves on her. Read is then said to have explained that her mother had raised her as a boy in order to pass her off as another man's son, that she had served as a sailor and foot soldier, and had come to Nassau when pirates captured a merchant ship she was serving aboard. Indeed, the two women may well have met after Bonnie mistook Read for a handsome young man, but the encounter almost certainly took place not at sea, but in Nassau. We know this because by the time Rackham and Bonnie decided to go pirating together, Mary Read was not only with them, her identity and gender were already well known to Governor Rogers, who identified the women by name in an official proclamation released to the Boston newspapers. The legends are essentially correct. The women did indeed become cross-dressing pirates. Late on the night of August 22, 1720, Rackham, Anne Bonny, Mary Read, and six men stole one of the swiftest vessels in all of the Bahamas, the William, a 12-ton, 6-gun sloop belonging to privateer John, catch him if you can, Ham. The watch aboard the Delicia challenged the pirates as they left the harbor, but they talked their way out of trouble, claiming they were going to stand outside the harbor for the evening after having broken their anchor line. Instead, they took the William round to the backside of New Providence and began plundering fishing canoes and other vessels from locations all over the Bahamas, their numbers growing as unhappy sailors and former pirates joined their company. Rackham and Bonnie also went out of their way to track down Richard Turnley, whom they knew to be hunting turtles on one of the Bahamas' outer cays. They destroyed his boat and pressed three of his crewmen, while Turnley and his young son hid in the woods. They left behind a fourth crewman with a message for Turnley. If Rackham and Bonnie ever came across him again, they would whip him to death. Over the next 2 months, Bonnie and Read became inseparable, and in matters of fashion, developed a compromise between them. When they saw any vessel, gave chase, or attacked, they wore men's clothes, as Read preferred, a former captive would later testify at their trial, and at other times they wore women's clothes. At a time when women sailors were unheard of, Bonnie and Read actively participated in combat, running gunpowder for the men, fighting in battles, and terrorizing their captives. Dorothy Thomas, a fisherwoman detained by the pirates on the north side of Jamaica, testified that the two women wore men's jackets and long trousers and had handkerchiefs wrapped around their heads, a machete and pistol in their hands, and cursed and swore at the men, urging that they should kill her to prevent her testifying against them. Thomas added that the only reason she knew they were women was by the largeness of their breasts. On October 20th, 1720, the pirates daringly attacked the sloop Mary and Sarah while she lay at anchor in Dry Harbor on the north shore of Jamaica. The vessel's captain noted that Bonnie had a gun in her hand, and that they were both very profligate, cursing and swearing much, and very ready and willing to do anything on board. Despite having his lover aboard, Rackham continued to pursue a reckless strategy. He spent much of October on the shores of Jamaica, hopping from harbor to harbor, stealing small vessels and recruiting additional crewmen. Soon he was being dogged by several Jamaican privateers, including one commanded by former Bahamian pirate Jean Bondavet, who had been terrorizing Spanish shipping. Bondavet caught up with Rackham while he was collecting recruits from shore near the western tip of Jamaica. Rather than trying to conceal his identity, Rackham promptly fired on Bondavet's vessel. Bondavet retreated to report the incident to Captain Jonathan Barnett, a privateer who had been hunting for Rackham in his own well-armed sloop. Barnett chased Rackham throughout the afternoon and into the night, during which time many of Rackham's men fell to drinking. The alcohol may have affected the pirates' handling of their swift vessel because at 10 o'clock, Barnett came within hailing distance. He ordered them to strike immediately to the King of England's colors. Somebody on Rackham's sloop responded, "We will strike no strikes," at which point Barnett's men fired a swivel gun. At this point, most of Rackham's men fled into the hold, leaving Reed and Bonnie on deck. Reed, according to the general history, called to those under deck to come up and fight like men, and finding they did not stir, fired her arms down the hold amongst them, killing one and wounding others. Moments later, Barnett's men fired a broadside, backed by a hail of small arms fire, causing the pirate's boom to crash onto the deck, followed by the shot-ridden mainsail. Unable to maneuver their vessel, the pirates begged for quarter. Barnett's men stormed over the rails, took everyone aboard into custody, and the next morning delivered them to the militia officer ashore. Soon thereafter, Calico Jack, Anne Bonny, and Mary Reed found themselves in Spanish Town Jail, awaiting trial. Among their fellow prisoners was Charles Vane. It's not known if the pirates were able to speak to one another, but if they did, Vane may have had some harsh words for his former quartermaster. Had Rackham not led the uprising against him 2 years earlier, Vane might have succeeded in building a pirate fleet comparable to those once commanded by Bellamy and Blackbeard. Once divided, neither man had the strength to do any serious damage to the British Empire. Rackham was among the first to be tried and found guilty. On November 18, 1720, the day of his execution, Anne Bonny was allowed to see him one last time. "I'm sorry to see you here," she is said to have told him, "but if you had fought like a man, you need not have hanged like a dog." Later that day, he and four other men were executed at Gallows Point in Port Royal. His body was later placed in a gibbet on a small island in the harbor, now known as Rackham's Cay. He and Vane may have been hanged separately, but their corpses swung within sight of each other across Port Royal Harbor. As for Mary Reed and Anne Bonny, they were tried on November 28, 1720, found guilty, and sentenced to death. They had a surprise for Governor Laws and the other officials at the Spanish Town Courthouse. They pled their bellies, claiming to be quick with child, and thus ineligible for execution, as it was illegal for the court to take the lives of their fetuses. Laws ordered that the women be examined, whereupon their claim was found to be true. Their sentences were postponed, and the women were presumably returned to prison. Mary Reed died there from a violent fever and was buried at St. Catherine's Church in Jamaica on April 28, 1721. Anne Bonny's fate is unclear, though she was apparently not executed. During her pregnancy, her long-estranged father, a South Carolina planter of some means, may have been able to obtain her release. If she died on Jamaica, the records of her burial have been lost. With the execution of Rackham and Vane, the golden age of piracy was all but over. While ships would continue to be attacked, particularly off West Africa, The pirates never again had the upper hand. With few exceptions, the pirates of the 1720s spent their time playing cat-and-mouse games with the authorities. There were to be no more threats to the colonies themselves. British authorities estimated the worldwide pirate population at approximately 2,000 between 1716 and 1718, but less than 200 by 1725, a collapse of 90%. After 1722, most pirates had abandoned any hope of carving out their own republic or helping overthrow the Hanoverian kings of England, and spent most of their time fighting for mere survival. That's not to say that all of the flying gang pirates were defeated. Indeed, many of the diehards who abandoned the Bahamas in 1718 carried on for years, and a few managed to retire comfortably. Olivier Labuse, Bellamy's longtime consort, went to the Leeward Islands with his ship of force prior to the Pirate Republic's collapse. On June 12, 1718, Captain Francis Humes, HMS Scarborough, cornered Labuse at La Blanquilla, where he had anchored to plunder a small prize sloop. As the frigate approached, Labuse and most of his crew made their escape on the faster, more nimble sloop. He eventually made his way to West Africa, meeting up with a number of Bahamian colleagues, including Edward England and Palsgrave Williams. He had a long and generally prosperous career in Africa and the Indian Ocean until 1730, when he was apprehended by French authorities and executed on the island of Réunion. His grave is a popular tourist site there. Palsgrave Williams also wound up in Africa, where he was last seen in April 1720, serving as quartermaster aboard Labuse's brigantine. A man held captive on that vessel, slaver captain William Snellgrave, recalled that Williams was grouchy and despondent, threatening him with violence without provocation. "Don't be afraid of him, for it is his usual way of talking," another captive told Snellgrave, "but be sure to call him captain as soon as you get aboard his vessel." Indeed, Williams warmed to the use of his old title, as he was unhappy not being in command. Snellgrave also reported that members of the pirate fleet drank toasts to King James III, suggesting continued Jacobite proclivities among Williams's associates. Williams probably sailed with Labuse for some time thereafter, possibly settling among other aging pirates in Madagascar. He never again saw his wife and children in Rhode Island, but his eldest son apparently never forgot him. When he grew up, Palsgrave Williams Jr. became a wig maker, specializing in the peruke his father was so fond of wearing. The rank-and-file pirates who stole Rogers's privateer Buck helped spawn a new wave of outlaws who would terrorize the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Led by Howell Davis, a fearless Welshman, they plundered vessels from Virginia to West Africa. In November 1719, he forced a carpenter named Bartholomew Roberts to serve aboard the Buck. After Davis was killed a short time later during an attack on a Portuguese slave fortress, Roberts presided over what was probably one of the most productive pirate companies in history, taking over 400 vessels before they were captured by the Royal Navy in February 1722. Another Buck mutineer was Walter Kennedy, an Irishman inspired to piracy by the tales of Henry Avery. After running his own pirate sloop for a time, he returned to London to enjoy his riches, set up his own brothel on Deptford Road, and dabbled in mugging and other petty crime. He was eventually apprehended and executed for piracy in 1721 at Wapping, where he had been born 26 years earlier. One of Kennedy's old shipmates aboard the Buck, Thomas Anstice, also became a successful pirate captain, but was killed by his own crew during a 1723 mutiny. It was Edward England, Vane's first quartermaster, who may have been the one to live out the Avery legend. After parting ways with Vane, England specialized in attacking slave ships on the west coast of Africa, whose demoralized crews were reliable sources of fresh manpower. He captured 9 such vessels in the spring of 1719, and more than a third of their sailors defected to his company. At Cape Corso, he nearly captured Lawrence Prince's new command, the 250-ton Witta II, which fled under the guns of a slave fort to avoid following her namesake into piracy. He, like Avery, spent considerable time cruising the Indian Ocean. He raided the shipping of the Mughal Empire, and upon catching a 34-gun ship, named it Fancy, as Avery had done. In the end, his men deposed him for refusing to allow them to harm their captives, marooning him on one of the islands of Mauritius, east of Africa. England managed to build a raft and conveyed himself to Madagascar, where he lived the rest of his days among Avery's surviving pirates. For the most part, the pirates' nemeses and their high-level collaborators fared worse than the pirates themselves. After abandoning Rogers in Nassau, Commodore Peter Chamberlain of the HMS Milford remained in charge of the Royal Navy's West Indies fleet until June 1720, when he received orders to escort 14 merchant vessels back to London. On June 28th, while passing through the Windward Passage, the fleet encountered a violent storm that drove every vessel ashore on the west end of Cuba. A witness later said, "The shore was covered with dead bodies." 2/3 of the 450 sailors and passengers were killed, including Chamberlain and the entire complement of the Milford, apart from 34 sailors, the purser, and a blind cook. Francis Hume, commander of the HMS Scarborough, who destroyed the pirate vessels of Martel and La Buse, was rewarded in 1723 with the command of the third-rate Bedford, one of only 12 ships of the line then in service. Nonetheless, he shot and killed himself in Scotland on account of some private discontent in February 1753. Vincent Pierce's Phoenix was based in New York for many years, allowing him to build many lasting relationships among the leading citizens of that city. These led to his marriage to Mary Morris, the daughter of New Jersey Governor Lewis Morris, who owned a vast estate in what is now the Bronx. The marriage was not a happy one. While Pierce was in England, Mary carried on a dalliance with another naval officer. Pierce didn't discover the affair until a few years later, when the couple was living in London. Enraged, he brought her to court for adultery. The scandal was voluminously documented in the Morris family's letters to one another and descended into a soap opera of lawsuits, countersuits, abortive reconciliation, and intrigue. In 1742, while Pierce fought his wife in London, a New York court ruled against him in a 1,500-pound lawsuit on an unrelated matter, which likely ruined him. He was probably still quarreling with his wife when he died in May 1745. Shortly after killing Blackbeard, Lieutenant Robert Maynard was found to have kept a number of valuables taken from the adventure, having disobeyed a direct order from Captain Gordon to return them to the inventory of seized plunder. His self-aggrandizing accounts of the battle at Ocracoke further discredited him with his superiors and Governor Spotswood, in whose letters praise for the lieutenant is conspicuously absent. Maynard was not promoted to commander for another 21 years. He eventually made captain and was given command of the 6th-rate Sheerness in September 1740, when he must have been an old man. He died in England in 1750. While cleared of wrongdoing by his governing council, Governor Charles Eden's reputation never recovered from his dealings with Blackbeard. He died of yellow fever at his home in Edenton on March 17, 1722, at the age of 49. His tombstone carried the epitaph, "He brought ye country into a flourishing condition, and died much lamented. Assisted by the fallout from his invasion of North Carolina, Alexander Spotswood's political enemies succeeded in having him replaced as governor of Virginia. In September 1722, Spotswood retired to his 45,000-acre estate, where he dabbled in iron mining and production. In the 1730s, he served as deputy postmaster general of the American colonies, established postal service between Williamsburg and Philadelphia, and selected Benjamin Franklin to be Pennsylvania's postmaster. In 1740, he was appointed major general and asked to lead a detachment of troops to fight in Spain during the War of the Austrian Succession. On June 7, 1740, while overseeing their departure, he died of fever in Annapolis, Maryland. Ironically, Lord Archibald Hamilton, the discredited governor of Jamaica, fared better than the rest. He had left Jamaica under arrest, but despite his Jacobite scheming and encouragement of piracy, he was found innocent of all wrongdoing by British courts. In 1721, the Council of Trade and Plantations even ordered the government of Jamaica to pay Hamilton his share of the plunder seized by his privateers in 1716. He married an earl's daughter, retained estates and castles in Ireland and Scotland, and died at his comfortable home on London's Pall Mall in 1754, at the ripe old age of 84, after which he was buried at Westminster Abbey. He had long before given up interest in a Stuart restoration, and appears to have done nothing to assist in the final Jacobite uprising in 1745, led by James Stuart's son, Bonnie Prince Charlie. James Stuart and his son are interred in the crypt of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. The descendants of King George occupy the British throne to this day. As for Woodes Rogers, he spent the twilight years of the golden age of piracy in London, sickly, indebted, and deeply depressed. "For some time," Rogers later wrote, "I was very much perplexed with the melancholy prospect of my affairs." His fellow investors had dissolved their partnership, and neither they nor the government would honor the £6,000 in debts Rogers had incurred on its behalf. In the end, it was his creditors who took pity on him, absolving his debts and getting him out of debtor's prison. In 1722 or 1723, he was approached by a man who was researching a book about the pirates. The author needed Rogers's help to fill in details of the pirate republic that Rogers had put down, and perhaps share copies of his official letters and reports as governor. Rogers apparently agreed, as the author included information only Rogers could have provided. The result, in May 1724, was the publication of A General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates, which, like so many books of that era, was written under an alias, in this case, Captain Charles Johnson. English readers were captivated by the activities of the pirates, even as they were taking place. It was an enormous hit on both sides of the Atlantic, going through numerous editions. Articles and advertisements promoting it appeared in London's Weekly Journal, as well as the Philadelphia's American Weekly Mercury. The book, still in print, almost single-handedly created the popular images of the pirates that remain with us today. Generations of historians and librarians have erroneously identified Captain Charles Johnson as Daniel Defoe, a contemporary of Rogers and the author of Robinson Crusoe and Captain Singleton. Recently, Arne Bialushevsky of the University of Kiel in Germany has identified a far more likely candidate. Nathaniel Mist, a former sailor, journalist, and publisher of the Weekly Journal. The book's first publisher of record, Charles Rivington, had printed many books for Mist, who lived just a few yards from his office. More importantly, the general history was registered at His Majesty's Stationery Office in Mist's name. As a former seaman who had sailed the West Indies, Mist, of all London's writer-publishers, was uniquely qualified to have penned the book, being well acquainted with the maritime world and the settings the pirates had operated in. Mist was also a committed Jacobite and would eventually go into exile in France, serving as a messenger between London and the Stuart court in Rome, which would explain the general history's not entirely unsympathetic account of the maritime outlaws. In 1722 to 1723, Mist also had the motivation to try to write a bestseller. The weekly journal's profits had been languishing for years due to increased competition from rival newspapers. The publication of A General History, which highlighted Rogers's role in dispersing the Bahamian pirates, revived the deposed governor's reputation as a national hero. Readers, including many members of Britain's elite, couldn't help but wonder what had happened to Rogers, and were undoubtedly embarrassed to discover how poorly he had been repaid for his patriotic service. It is probably not a coincidence that Rogers's fortunes began to recover not long thereafter. In early 1726, he successfully petitioned the king for redress. Authorities were sympathetic when they read Rogers's plea, which was written in the third person. "He has lost 8 years of the prime of his life by his honest ambition and zeal in serving his country, and is left destitute of money for this service or any new employment, though no complaint has yet been made of any maladministration or want of doing his duty." In the end, the king not only awarded Rogers with a pension equivalent to half the salary of an infantry captain, retroactive to June 1721, he also appointed him in 1728 to a second term as the governor of the Bahamas. Before leaving for New Providence, Rogers sat for what may have been his only portrait. The painter, William Hogarth, placed Rogers in a romanticized version of Nassau. Rogers, in white wig and an elegant full-length jacket, is seated in a comfortable armchair, his face turned in profile, concealing the disfigurement left by a Spanish musket ball. At his back is the bastion of Fort Nassau, on which an ornamental plaque can be seen, which bears his personal motto, "Dum spiro, spero." While I breathe, I hope. Rogers, then 50, has a globe to his left, symbolizing his circumnavigation, and a pair of dividers in his right hand, with which he is about to take the measurements of the Island of Providence from a map held in his son's hand. William Whetstone Rogers, who would accompany his father to Nassau, is standing wearing the wig and elegant clothing of a gentleman. Daughter Sarah Rogers sits to the left, awaiting a servant with a plate of fruit. In the harbor behind them, a large warship lets off a multi-gun salute. When Rogers and his son arrived in Nassau on August 25, 1729, Nassau wasn't quite as pleasant as Hogarth had imagined. The island had just been stricken by a hurricane, and many of its residents lay in their battered homes, weakened by contagious fever. The economy and fortifications remained a shambles, and the outgoing governor's wife had upset many of Nassau's inhabitants by trying to use her position to intimidate justices, monopolize shopkeeping, and hire away other people's servants before their terms of indenture had expired. There had been a few improvements in the 8 years that Rogers had been away. A new church in the town center, a stone gatehouse at the entrance to the fort, and Government House, a two-story Georgian residence where Rogers would spend the final years of his life. His final term was easier than the first, but less than relaxing. He wound up locked in a bitter dispute with the representatives to the colony's new governing assembly over the imposition of local taxes. Rogers wished to raise money to repair the fort. The assemblyman did not. frustrated with their intransigence, Rogers took the extreme step of dissolving the assembly, upsetting local planters. By early 1731, the fight had worn Rogers out. He became ill and, as before, went to Charleston to recover his health. In the meantime, his son, the governing council's clerk, did his best to build the family a proper slave plantation, making several trips to West Africa to purchase the requisite labor force. He would die from fever in the port of Whydah during such a trip in 1735, while he was serving as one of the Royal Africa Company's three chief merchants. Governor Rogers returned to New Providence in May of 1731, but he was never able to truly recover his health. He passed away on July 15, 1732, and was buried in Nassau. His grave has since been lost, but his name adorns the main street on the city's waterfront, and he is honored in the official motto of the Bahamas, Ex pulsis piratis commercia restitua, pirates expelled, commerce restored.
This concludes the reading of The Republic of Pirates, being the true and surprising story of the Caribbean pirates and the man who brought them down, by Colin Woodard. Copyright 2007 by Colin Woodard. This book was read by Lewis Grenville. This unabridged recording was published by a special arrangement with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.